Right. Well, this is the second in presentation in a two-month series that I'm offering. The title of the series is Earth Sila, and the subtitle is Living the Buddha's Teachings in Our Environmental Relations. There's a teaching that the Buddha gives called the Five Daily Recollections, things to keep in mind to help keep you sort of present and motivated in your practice. First one, I am of the nature to age. I have not gotten beyond aging. The second is, I am subject to illness and infirmity. I have not gotten beyond illness and infirmity. The third one is, I am of a nature to die. I have not gotten beyond death. The fourth one is, all that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. Anicca. Okay. Fifth one, I am born of my karma. I am heir to my karma. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. My actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I shall become the heir. So, my actions are my relations. What that whole set of phrases about is a teaching on karma, which is basically just a teaching on causes and effects. Okay. Actions and their consequences. Being mindful of the actions that you are contemplating taking and that you do take in terms of what their karmic consequences are going to be. Very simply put, whether your speech, your individual actions, your way of life has the effect of perpetuating suffering for yourself and others, or if instead it has the effect of bringing suffering to an end. So this subtitle of our series, Living the Buddha's Teachings in Our Environmental Relations, is about just that. Because when the Buddha says our actions are our protections, he means that when we are acting for the benefit of all beings, for the cessation of suffering, that creates an aura of protection around ourselves and all those for whom we come in contact. So this series is looking at ways that we might refresh and revive, regenerate, rebirth our relationship with all sentient beings and with the environment itself. That's the underlying intention. And so sila is a Pali word. It's a collective term for three aspects of the Eightfold Path, the ones having to do with the fruition of our meditation practice and our study, our wisdom, insofar as how we speak, how we act, and how we live. Last week, we talked about environmental communication, how to evaluate discourse on environmental affairs that we hear, and evaluate the nature of our own speech in the realm of environmental affairs. This week we're looking at the second realm, okay, that of individual actions. And within that, what I've done is to insert into the study of individual actions what are called the five precepts. And these are basically training guidelines that the Buddha gave. And there are varying numbers of precepts depending on how deeply involved one is in practicing Buddha Dharma in this particular tradition. So for monks and nuns, there are over 230 precepts. The idea being that if there's a rule for everything, including using the jhan, and there is, that it will have the effect of measurably, you know, heightening the state of mindfulness with which you do everything in your life. Happily, for those of us living the lay life, there are five or eight, depending on, you know, how serious about it you want to get. For our purposes, just five. And they are undertaking the precept to not kill. Undertaking the training precept to not take that which is not given. Undertaking the precept to abstain from sexual misconduct. undertaking the precept to refrain from false speech, and undertaking the precept to refrain from imbibing intoxicants or anything that will interfere with mindfulness, with one's ability to be clear-minded, that will increase the likelihood of doing something unskillful. So this evening I want to talk about the precept of not killing, where that came from, how it was introduced, how it was originally understood, how it was brought forth for the present day, and then how it might apply in terms of our environmental relations generally. So when we looked at speech and why we find it sometimes difficult to talk about environmental affairs in a constructive way from the standpoint of Buddha Dharma, many of us found it's because when we come across things in the news about perhaps a genuine and relatively unprecedented environmental crisis that we may be entering into now, and then we read news about the evident incapacity of governments to do anything about it, whether at the local or the national or international level. But it tends to arouse feelings of despair and disempowerment, an inclination to withdraw. And then from the standpoint of that state of mind, then, why give voice to it? So there's a reticence to even engage in environmental discourse. And then the felt need to have a closer look at what is a mind state from which constructive and positive non-dual environmental communication might be a possibility. And so in each of these times that we spend together in this Earth Thila series, we're looking at what's the state of mind from which comes your speech, your actions. In doing this, it's really important for us to begin with a closer look at the language that we use, the terms that we use. So one of the core functions of human learning is to gain knowledge of the unknown by comparing it to what we do know. And such was the case with regard to the earliest English language translations of what the historical Buddha is actually thought to have said in terms of the very earliest Pali language transcriptions of his teachings. So perhaps the most historically notable effort occurred starting in the 1880s with the founding of the Pali Text Society in Sri Lanka. And it was founded by these British civil servants who, when they're sent into the field to administer the colonies that they had acquired by whatever means, it was required of them that they learn as much as they could about the local culture and the local language. And so they undertook to translate into English these very ancient Pali texts, the actual discourses, the teachings that the Buddha actually gave, which were handed down over the first few hundred years just within the form of poetry, the recitation, the oral tradition, before they were committed to writing. And the other literature that developed over the years to follow it. Whenever the monks and nuns living in community would kind of get into it a little bit and start having some trouble, they go to the Buddha and ask how to resolve a certain issue or how to apply his teachings to a particular form of living in the world. And he would give them an answer to the question that they asked, and they wrote down those answers, and it sort of became kind of like case law, right? It was this list of rules for how to live together in community for the monks and nuns. It was called Vinaya, code of conduct for those in the monastic sangha. And then there was the organization of the Buddha's discourses into categories, having to do with states of mind. So these documents all together formed what came to be called the Pali Canon. As these texts were rendered into English, they were rendered into the English of the translators, of course, who were these British civil servants and also some missionaries and others who had taken an interest. And so, not surprisingly, what we get is the English translations of the Pali Canon, the earliest ones, shot through with the ecclesiastical language of the Anglican Church and 19th and 18th century British moral philosophers. So sila, the time is rendered as morality, moral conduct, virtuous conduct, ethical conduct. The value of these renderings was to make Pali texts relatable and intelligible to a non-Asian audience, and to also teach the Western world that this tradition was one that was worthy of respect, that they actually addressed the same topics that were addressed in the Western religions. The problem is that using that language came at a price, and that price is the culturally and intellectually infused baggage that those words are freighted with. A friend and Dharma teacher named Sharon Salzberg, when she would talk about one time she was kind of reflecting on the people who come to the Dharma from whatever faith tradition they may have been born to. And a lot of the people that she said come to the Dharma come in a state that she would refer to as being spiritually wounded, as if their spirits had been cleaved at an early age, taught to believe that we are inherently incomplete, flawed, and unworthy, and that only by surrendering to some external religious authority, the power to tell us who we are, might we be made whole again. So what happens as a result is that along with whatever faith tradition that we were born to, at least some of the more fundamental ones, there's a big dose of shame and guilt. That we had kind of been born into original sin simply by having been born into a body, right? And we sort of spend the rest of our lives trying to atone for that fact, you know, make up for that early conditioning. And all too often, the use of that kind of language can trigger those kinds of response, even though both the Asian teachers and the Westerners say, well, you know, that's not really the same kind of frame of mind. It's not a condemnatory teaching. It's more just more like natural history, you know, that if you want to bring suffering to an end for yourself and others, then you might want to think about speaking and acting and living this way instead of like that, you know. So it's a teaching precept, but still in all, that language just really has a deep grip. So in the course of preparing these lectures, or these talks and discussions, one of the things that's really been on my mind is instruction or advice that I've gotten over the years in terms of how to most skillfully do this. So I was at a reunion retreat for some of the teachers that I went through my own training program with a few years ago, and the invited teacher for our retreat was a person named Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a Pali scholar, one of the foremost English language translators of the Pali Canon, trained in this same Sri Lankan scholastic tradition as many of the other most notable scholars working in this area, as well, such as Bhikkhu Anilayo and Nanyipioca Thera and some other Yanomoli. These scholars who've deeply studied the Pali Canon texts in Pali and then rendered them into English in a way that they thought might be most beneficial. In this particular talk, someone asked Bhikkhu Bodhi, well, you know, you were one of the curators of the Pali Canon, you know, these classical teachings, trying to render them as accurately as possible in the words the Buddha's actually thought to have spoken. But a lot of the Dharma literature that we find in the West right now is of a different nature. You know, it's based much more on personal experience. You have Dharma teachers bringing in other other realms of understanding, other ways of framing the Dharma, whether it's psychotherapeutic language or poetry or a variety of other approaches that don't seem to have a whole lot to do with the literal texts of Theravada Buddhism. And what do you think about that? And Bhikkhu Bodhi's response to us was to say this. He said, well, you know, from the very time the Buddha taught and Buddha Dharma started to be shared, first throughout the part of Asia where he lived, then Southeast Asia and up into the Himalayas and up into China and Japan, that it has always taken two forms. One is the form of what he called canonical Buddhism, which is to say, just doing your best to teach what, to the best of our knowledge, the Buddha actually said, in the way that he said it. The concepts and the principles that the Buddha taught in the way that he taught them. Said the other form of Buddhism that he also felt to be very important was the one that he called adaptive Buddhism. He said, throughout history as well, it's been important for teachers to be able to translate what the Buddha was trying to get across into the idiom of the host culture, into the language of the host culture, into similes and metaphors that people in the host culture could understand. So seeking to try to convey the essence of the Buddha's teachings, the spirit of his teachings, even if it was not in the form of the letter of those teachings. Said the only thing you need to try to be clear about, you're speaking to us now, teaching Dharma, is which one you're doing. You know, try to be clear about which one you're doing. And so that advice for me has become very important in putting together this Earth Sila series. Okay, because the one thing he was saying, and then the other scholars at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies was, you know, just don't make stuff up. There's a lot of sayings and teachings and whatnot that are ascribed to the Buddha that there's no record of his ever having said. Okay, and so just be as clear as you can, number one, about whether you're teaching right out of the discourses, the Pali Canon, or whether you're interpreting them more liberally in a way that to make it more approachable, more accessible to whoever it is you're communicating to. And so for me, that's been really important advice. So in each of these sessions, what I'm trying to do, what I will be trying to do, I'm going to do this evening, is to try to be clear about which I'm doing and to lay out some of the canonical teachings and then give my own views by way of trying to stimulate some thought and maybe some discussion as to how that teaching might be applicable to this topic before us, you know, having to do with application to our daily lives in the realm of environmental relations. Okay. So one of the things that Bhikkhu Bodhi himself has started to do a little bit more over the years, as I mentioned at the last talk, in terms of emphasis, not that he's not one of the foremost ones making the point most assertively and continuously, that don't try to soft pedal the Buddhist teachings that aren't so easy to hear, like the importance of cleaning up your act, right? But rather doing it in a way that also doesn't reinforce the kind of dualism and self-condemnation that we sort of inherited along with the language. So there's much more emphasis now on the notion of harmony. How do we live in greater harmony with other sentient beings? How do we live in greater harmony with the environment? Because if you listen to a lot of environmental discourse that's out there these days, it tends to be kind of adversarial and accusatory in nature. It tends to frame humans as having been born into, I don't know what you might call, original environmental sin. That we, just by virtue of having been born on the earth, we're already doing a lot of rotten stuff, you know, in terms of, you know, climate change and habitat destruction and whatnot. It's all our fault. And, there is an off-Broadway show a long time, 1971, that was, it was called Lemmings. It was kind of a satirical send-up of Woodstock, actually, and there were some totally unheard of veterans of Chicago's Second City that were that put this series of skits together, and included people like Chevy Chase and John Belushi and Christopher Guest. I think Jane Curtin may have been in there. It was really funny and satirical and blasphemous, of course. And one of the things they had in there is about what's the most highly sensitized way you can inhabit the earth. And they said, well, what you really ought to do is dig yourself a grave, get into it, and beat yourself to death with a club. Kind of taking it to an extreme, right? But nonetheless, we kind of get this sense that we're just wrong. You know, what we're doing here is just no good, and we ought to be ashamed of ourselves, and then we should spend our whole lives in sort of penitence for this wrongdoing. Not so beneficial, you know. If in addition to remorse, despair, you know, withdrawal, sense of powerlessness, we also feel guilty, not so helpful. Not so helpful. Really important to discover a different state of mind from which we can begin to understand some of these phenomena and begin to work together. So, basically, if what we are about is learning step by step, incrementally, to try to live our lives in ways that are less harmful and more beneficial for ourselves and all sentient beings, okay, that is a different view. It's a different kind of motivation to bring to life on this earth. It's a different kind of motivation to bring to our regard for our relationships to other sentient beings. Without that sort of residue of guilt or of anxiety about wrongdoing, but simply little bit by little bit becoming progressively more attuned to whether there are ways that we live our lives both individually and as a group that might be doing unknowing harm. And as we awaken to those, are there ways that we can begin to shift toward doing things that are less harmful and that are more beneficial? So, as promised, I want to spend just a few moments now talking about the canonical teachings on this precept of not killing. So, this is some text drawn from an essay on the refuges and precepts that Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote a few years ago that is published in Access to Insight, having to do with sort of the specifics of the teachings about not killing. First of the five precepts in Pali, Panatipata viramani sika padam samadhiyami. In English, I undertake the training rule to abstain from taking life. Here the word pana, meaning that which breathes, denotes any living being that has breath and consciousness. It includes animals and insects as well as men, but does not include plants as they have only life but not breath or consciousness. More about that later. The word living being is a conventional term, an expression of common usage, signifying the strict philosophical sense of the faculty of life. The word atipata means literally striking down, hence killing or destroying. So, there it gets sort of formulaic here at some point as well. It talks about a complete act of killing constituting a full violation. The precept involves five factors: a living being, the perception of the living being as such, the thought or volition of killing, the appropriate effort, and the actual death as the result of the action. Misunderstanding, killing can take two forms. One is the direct taking of life oneself, and the other is ordering that it be done. Is giving the instruction for or authorizing the taking of life. So there's also a kind of a hierarchy in terms of the taking of life in terms of what its karmic consequences turn out to be. And that includes things of such as who is being killed. It includes things like, first distinction is given between killing beings with moral qualities and killing beings without moral qualities. For all practical purposes, the former are human beings, the latter are animals. It's held that to kill a fellow human being is a more serious matter ethically than to kill an animal. Further distinctions are drawn between large animals and small animals. More karmic points against you if you kill a big one. Others have to do with the fact of whether it's domestic or wild. Insofar as killing other human beings are concerned, there's also a gradation in the karmic point system having to do with intention. Actually reflects the Buddhist, the British common law criminal code in terms of intention, all right, and then the gravity of the karmic consequences, interestingly, are similar to what you find in other societies with caste systems. So, for instance, in traditional, in the Hindu culture of his time, as well as in British culture, there was much less grave offense to kill somebody of a lower station in life than you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Servant kills a master, automatic death penalty. Okay. It's true in Britain. It's true in the Hindu culture of the Buddhist time. It gets translated a bit differently when it comes to karmic scorekeeping in Buddha Dharma, which is rather that it's a more grave offense in terms of the karmic consequences if you kill somebody who is at a higher level of spiritual maturity than you are. So about as bad as it gets is if you kill a monk or a nun or an arahat, you know, a being approaching enlightenment. When I took one of my sabbaticals in Thailand a few years ago, among the things I went there to study was this phenomenon that was turning up in the literature called the ecology monks. And what I came to learn, both from reading and also when I was in Thailand, that the monastic sangha in Thailand is really kind of divided into two main groups. One are the monastics who are part of the big urban temples, and often they're very closely allied with the government in terms of officiating at government ceremonies and government leaders, you know, going to their wats and whatnot, and so they tend to put the Buddhist imprimatur on pretty much whatever actions the government decides it wants to take, including the clear cutting of the hardwood forests. And then there are the forest monks. Okay, and the forest monk tradition is quite different. These are people who live out in the rural areas, and they are very closely allied with the peasantry that lives out there as well, because that's the communities that support them. And they tend to be also sort of environmental activists. You know, one of these, Ajahn Buddhadasa, in the 1960s, he was very nearly jailed for speaking out against the urban monastic support for the Thai government's development of resources in a way that was destroying habitat, that was destroying the rainforests in the mountainous areas of Thailand. And the Thai forest tradition, as it's called, Thai, is one which some members of which, and it's been kind of controversial, have taken some direct actions in an effort to try to prevent this devastation. One of the direct actions they've taken in some areas, these groups call the ecology monks, is they go out into the bush, into the areas where the government has decreed that there shall be no logging. So they've got these great environmental laws on the books, just like we do, except everyone ignores them and the government doesn't enforce them. So there's a huge amount of bootleg logging going on back in the boonies in rural Thailand, up in the mountainous areas, and everyone knows it's going on. And so what these monks were doing was going out into these areas that they know were being threatened by bootleg logging, especially where there was a lot of old growth forests out there, and they had ordained some of the senior trees as monks. And they would hold ordination ceremonies, and they would wrap robes around them, and they would come to them to receive teachings. And this turned out to be a somewhat effective means of cutting back on the bootleg logging, because any Thai Buddhist bootleg logger who cut down one of those trees was killing a monk. And there is very heavy duty, very nasty karma that comes along with doing that in their training. And so this turned out to be a kind of a relevant factor, okay, insofar as the way they have tried to preserve their environment. So, how does all this play out in terms of what actually happens on the ground? Application in the time of the Buddha, neither the Buddha nor his followers were vegetarians. The reason is because they were completely reliant on the alms of the people in the villages and the culture and the society where they lived. And the culture and the society where they lived was not vegetarian in nature. And so they took and they ate what was given to them. The proximate cause of the Buddha's death was eating pork that had become toxically spoiled before it was cooked. And it said that he knew this and he ate it anyway because it was offered. The distinction that he did make for his followers, however, was that if he knew a meal was to be prepared specifically for them, that they should request that no animals be killed for that purpose. So it seems they were trying to edge their society toward getting increasingly more sensitized to what it meant to take life. At the same time, in the Buddha's time, there and in his own culture, there were various other teachings out there as well in terms of what it was and was not appropriate to eat based upon the taking of life. There was one form of vegetarians that just said you can eat anything but mammals. There was another strict vegetarian that said eating no animals at all. There was veganism, not eating any form of animal-produced protein, like milk or eggs, or cheese, even if the animal is not killed. And then there was Jainism, which is to eat nothing that had to be killed, including plants, including harvested vegetables. Though it was okay to eat fruits and nuts since the plant that produced them was unharmed in the process. Here's an article from a few years ago from the Christian Science Monitor. And it has to do with whether or not plants have consciousness. The late Nobel Prize-winning plant geneticist Barbara McClintock called plant cells thoughtful. Darwin wrote about root-tip brains. Not only can plants communicate with each other and with insects by coded gas exhalations, the scientists now say, they can perform Euclidean geometry calculations through cellular computations and, like a peeved boss, remember the tiniest transgression for months. To a growing number of biologists, the fact that plants are now known to challenge and exert power over other species is proof of a basic intellect. If intelligence is the capacity to acquire and apply knowledge, then absolutely plants are intelligent, agrees Leslie Seabirth, a biologist at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. So the mere fact they don't have brains and spinal columns and nervous systems, in the view of a growing number of botanists, does not get in the way of their having fairly highly developed senses of how to communicate, of how to ward off danger, of how to attract the insects they do want and shoo away the ones they don't want, of how to tell each other about oncoming droughts or fires, and of planning up to 2 years ahead based on their history of weather patterns in terms of how they're going to operate their bodies for the next couple. So, it would appear, you know, those Buddhist teachings, of Theravada teachings from the time, were based on the knowledge they had at the time. We have different knowledge now. And so it looks as if there's a fairly good basis, you know, for where the Jains were coming from, in fact, and saying, essentially, life feeds on life. And for the most part, most of us are here because something was killed so we could exist, so we could eat, whether it was plants or animals. There are also cultural variations within Buddha Dharma. For instance, the Zen monks developed soy sauce, tempeh, and tofu as ways to try to concentrate the amount of protein in their diet, and doing it only with plants. The U.S. Vipassana retreats are vegetarian in part because the Western teachers who came over here and started teaching had mostly been sitting in India, where they practiced strict vegetarianism. And also out of respect for the yogis attending retreats, and we're talking in the present day as well, in places like Spirit Rock and Insight Meditation Society, out of respect for the people who come there to practice who are vegetarian. It's their understanding of the most sensitized way to observe this first of the precepts. However, the same is not true of the Southeast Asian monks in Thailand and Burma, for instance. 1977, the abbot of the Insight Meditation Center in Rangoon, Mahasi Sayadaw, was invited to come teach at the Insight Meditation Society. He brought quite a retinue with him. He also brought a lot of canned seafood and dried seasoned meats and things like that that made up their diet that the vegetarian cook staff at IMS had to prepare for them. And so there was some, you know, intercultural learning that went along with that. I was guest at the Thai Wat here in Denver some time ago when there was, I'd gotten to know some of the monks out there a little bit, and some of them had invited me to come for a special ceremony, and they were making a meal, and one of the dishes that one of the monks prepared said, he's really good at this dish, and he's very authentic, he must have it, and it was a sardine salad. Fortunately, I like sardines, so that wasn't a problem. But, you know, again, it's just to demonstrate the different cultures always teaching in a different way as far as what is killed in order that we might eat. I was on a retreat at Taramandala a few years ago, a Dzogchen retreat with a teacher named Mingjur Dorji. And we were having a vegetarian diet, the yogis were, at the retreat. So one day I was working in the kitchen, and one of the people working there was hacking up this beef stew meat. So I said, oh, that's interesting, you know, what's that about? And he said, well, Mingjur Dorji is a growing boy. And there was one of his favorite dishes was these beef dumplings that they had in Tibet. And so they were making that for him. Tibet's one of those countries where it's really hard to come by enough protein in any form. You know, and so they eat whatever's available. Interestingly, in some Tibetan culture, traditionally for a long time, they had Muslim butchers So they didn't have to do the killing, but they could still do the eating. When Jack Kornfield, one of my teachers, was spending time in robes as a monk in Thailand, when he first got there and was going out, he's at Ajahn Chah's monastery, going out on alms rounds, and they came in with, you know, they go out in the morning at dawn and they just hold out their bowls for whatever the locals have that they're eating to share with them to help sustain the monastery. And he came back and there was a little bit of rice and some, you know, badly overcooked vegetables and some fried insects and a little bit of monkey meat, you know. And he kind of looked at it and said, wow, these people here must not have terribly high regard for the Dharma. And one of the other monks there who was with him said, oh no, many of these people have eaten no form of animal protein in months. They are giving you the very best of what they have. So it was Dana in its purest form, you know. So people who are living right at the edge like that, they eat what's there, you know, to help them make their way. So it's worth paying a little bit of attention to what is killed on our behalf. Yeah, please.
I was wondering if you could comment on this contradiction, as I see it, not harming animals for food, but yet we have evidence in our environment that animals eat animals.
Yes.
We see other animals eating animals.
Yes.
And also knowing that we have canine teeth, which leads us to believe that by way of nature, we are intended to eat animals. And so this idea that we shouldn't eat animals or we shouldn't harm animals seems a contradiction of being at peace with what is.
Sure. We are indeed omnivores. You know, there's an awful lot of evidence to show that to be the case. And when we get to the next session on not taking that which is given, distinguishing wants from needs, then we will have a closer look at that very question. For an awful lot of our history as a species, we ate whatever came along in order to be able to survive. And there's some historical evidence out there that the higher, the richer the quantity of protein that got into our diet, that may have had a real triggering effect in terms of our evolution, in terms of the growth of our brains and things like that. Okay. So there's no doubt that we were equipped to eat anything we could get our hands on, and we got better and better and better at getting our hands on things, and ate more and more protein-rich diets, and we're able to evolve in such a way that we essentially found ourselves able to conquer the world, okay, for better or for worse. And the point that we are at now, and the point that we're at the Buddha's time for that matter, was, well, we've gotten beyond that survival level, and now we have choices. It's not eat meat or die, you know. It's do you want to generate the karma that comes along with doing. And I know Dharma teachers who eat meat. Most of them, you know, don't eat any red meat, but insofar as adequate protein supplementation, some do, others don't. You know, but the good thing is that except for health reasons, we live in a munificent enough society that we have a lot of choice as to how we want to nourish ourselves. And so it does allow this sensitization to this question of what is killed so that we can live? And what do we want to authorize to be killed so that we can live based upon the choices we make? And, you know, later on in the series also we'll get to look at what the bioenergetic impacts are of eating different stages on the food pyramid, and, you know, how much energy goes into different food sources and that kind of thing. But basically, we are equipped to eat anything, and we have been for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. It's just that we have a lot more freedom now to choose. Okay. So it's worth each of us, you know, starting to pay a little bit of attention to what's killed on our behalf and why. Killing for food. Animals are killed for food. Plants are killed for food. Life feeds on life. So it's kind of up to us then to decide, what do we want to allow to be killed on our behalf in terms of what we choose to buy and eat. Animals are also killing the production of food, even if it's just vegetables. You know. There's an article, a cover story in Time magazine this week about the disappearance of bees, honeybees, in North America. It's called a colony collapse. Okay, they're just being wiped out. And the research that's being done on why this is so seems to be a combination of factors. One is that while in the old days they would spray insecticides on crops, you know, at certain times in order to keep them from gobbling up the plants or before, you know, they were going to be harvested, that what they do now increasingly is to soak the seeds in pesticides. To soak the seeds in insecticides. So it's less harmful for farm workers because there's not the residue out there. There's not as much pesticide residue getting into the water supply. Okay. But what it does do is to poison the entire plant for the entirety of its life, insofar as the insects are concerned. So when the bees come along and try to pollinate it, they're poisoned. And if they're not killed, their systems are weakened so that they fall prey to opportunistic diseases. And that's the current thinking about what might be going on there. There are other reasons that things get killed as well. We're losing about 100,000 species of plants and animals every year going extinct, mostly because of habitat destruction, mostly occasioned either by clearing land to grow food or raise livestock or to build human habitation. So the growth of the human population is very much linked to or tied to the fact that so many animal and plant species are being wiped off the face of the earth. An environmental side effect of other activities, such as war and energy development, plays a kind of a big role as well. So what we're left with then, in terms of our environmental relations, are some questions that we can just kind of sit with as individuals, as groups, and contemplate what might be done in order to move the needle a little bit in terms of our relationship with other sentient beings. One is, how can we become more aware of the killing that is being done on our behalf? Whether it, again, is it's got to do with just feeding us, or housing us, or providing energy sources. There's also a crash going on in terms of populations of amphibians around the world. That seems to be very closely tied to climate change and global warming because of the depth and the temperature of the waters that they need in order to replicate. So questions to kind of ponder, and we'll really have a closer look at these later on in the series, are things like, where does our food come? How is it raised and produced? How did it come to us? Okay. Michael Pollan's book, Food Rules, right? What are the three rules that he basically says, if you can hang with these, you're well on your way to sort of a more balanced life and one that's a little more sustainable. Okay. So first one was, eat food, and by that he meant don't eat anything that your grandmother would not recognize as food. Don't eat anything that has ingredients in it that a third grader couldn't pronounce. And so eat food, and he said mostly plants, because it's much less impactful on the ecosystem generally, you know, and organic ones at that. And then third is not too much. So, and we'll be getting into that in our next session on needs and wants. So in some ways it's quite simple, you know, but it takes reliable information. So this ongoing question of how we can adjust our behavior in such a way that less killing needs to happen on our behalf. That's essentially an awful lot of what this is about. You know? And there are indeed lots of very skillful ways of doing this that are already out there worth exploring. If you want to learn anything about permaculture, for instance, ask David. That's what he's doing for a living these days. And there are so many very skillful kinds of actions that are already being taken, ways of working with these issues that are out there. The information gathering that we're doing now is part of the development of the environmental relations page on the Buddhist Network, Insight Network website, and I'll make sure everyone gets the link to that. It's all about gathering these sources of information. It's all the Insight Meditation Sanghas in the country that are providing information going into this database on how we can kind of up our game a little bit in terms of obeying these precepts in our environmental relations. So I know it was a lot to kind of roll over onto you tonight. I'd like to open it up for just a few minutes for any questions or observations or reflections that anyone might have at this point. Yes, please.
Jim Chang, I come once in a blue room. I was curious about why you didn't talk more about war and other aspects of killing, humans killing other humans. And the conundrum that I see is like when the Taliban blew up that huge statue of the Buddha. It's 2,000, however old it was.
Bamiyan Buddhas, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then it became clear, you know, that they just operating in this place about the way they treat women and, you know, little girls trying to go to school, they throw acid in their face. And
the reason that I didn't go there this evening is because I was wanting to address specifically killing or taking life in the context of environmental relations.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a very worthy topic.
And sure, yes, sure.
So other reflections, comments, questions? Yes, please.
I wanted to comment something that touched me a long time ago. George Bernard Shaw was a vegetarian.
Uh-huh.
And he said, he was asked why he chooses this lifestyle, and he said, well, I'm looking forward when I die and when I'm buried, that all the chickens and all the sheep and every animal I didn't eat will be following my coffin.
Right. It gets us back to the very beginning once more. What does it mean to live in harmony with? So it's worth reflecting, you know, as a way of trying to get away from the original environmental sin notion, you know. It's worth reflecting when you go home and you look at how you're living your life. Start with all the things that you're doing now that have to do with care for other sentient beings. All the aspects of how you shop for food and decide what to eat, you know, whether you're going to spray pesticides on your flowers, all these other kinds of things. Think about all the beneficial things you're doing now, because almost all of us are. Because at root, we know the truth of what these teachings are. And so it's not a matter of starting from nada, it's a matter of starting from where we are and then seeing, gradually sensitizing ourselves to where we may go from here. Where we may go from here individually, how we might be able to help each other go from where we are to where we may wish to be as a group within this Sangha, within our communities, within our nation, and from around the world. Speaking of the world and the turning of the world, and the fact that I'm finding it very helpful in terms of sense of connection to end our time together with some music. I came across in the Old Testament of the Bible, there is this narrative poem that is basically all about Nietzsche and the Wheel of Life. And it's the book of Ecclesiastes. And the folk musician Pete Seeger took some of the phrases from the book of Ecclesiastes and put them to music. And it is about as straight up a Dharma teaching in musical form about Nietzsche that I know. And so I thought maybe we could close our time here this evening by sharing that reflection and memory together.
Have a good week.